Good morning, everybody. I am amazed to see this many people at 7:30 in the morning. I thought I was going to be only talking to one or two people, so I appreciate that very much. So I have been charged with providing a primer on the electric grid, and I want to start off with a warning that when you provide primers, there will be a lot of generalizations in this, and there are oftentimes exceptions to generalizations. So keep that in mind as we're going through. By the end of this, you'll know a lot more about the electric grid, but you will not be an expert. So with that, to understand today's electric grid, we actually need to go back to how the electric grid evolved over the last 140 years. The first setup was started by Thomas Edison in 1882 at the Pearl Street Station in New York City. And believe it or not, the system he set up has not changed very much over the last 140 years, though it is changing now, which is fantastic because we're seeing a dynamic change in our industry. So back in 1882, going forward till probably about 1990, this is really where we have been for all that time. There's three buckets of services provided in the electric industry. One is generation. So we've got a central station generation plant here. We've got long distance, extra high voltage transmission grid. That's what we're going to be focused on today. And then we've got the distribution system. So we've got three buckets. The flows were going in one direction from the power plant to the customers. Now, way back when, what happened was utilities were given service territories in which they were required to provide electricity service to the customers in those service territories. And each single utility had its own fiefdom, essentially, and it would figure out how much electricity its customers needed. It would build its own power plants and then build transmission to get to its customers. Now, one of the things that they would do would be, okay, let's just say our customers needed about 100 megawatts of power. They would estimate how much electricity their customers would need. When they were planning how much infrastructure to build, they would actually add on a little bit more just in case, right, it got to be really hot or a power plant went down. So they would actually build the infrastructure for about 110 or 115 megawatts. Now, if you can imagine, those 10 or 15 extra megawatts, those plants actually may never run, right? Because that's an insurance policy. And indeed, even probably the 90 to 100 megawatt plants called peaker plants may not run very often. Those are really, really expensive plants because generation plants only make money when they're selling their widgets, as I call it, their electricity to customers. And so what the utilities began to realize is, hey, maybe I shouldn't build my own peaker plants, right? Maybe I should work with my neighbor to share peaker plants. And that way, we'll be able to save some money in infrastructure. Well, if you started to do that, you know what you had to do as well? Not just build transmission from your own power plants to your own customers, but you had to then start building transmission from your power plants to your neighbor's power plants. So the transmission grid did start to expand based on those kinds of needs. So electricity is, for the most part, a just-in-time commodity, which is mind-blowing because electricity has to be generated almost instantaneously with need. So as an example, in England, at 4 o'clock, what happens at 4 o'clock in England? It's tea time, right? You know what happens? Every tea kettle in England turns on. Now, when that happens, the utilities actually have to ramp up their generators right before people start pushing those buttons on the tea kettles, or the grid becomes unstable. And one analogy we can use is the grid is like a plate spinning on a stick. And as you've got demand coming online, a weight is placed on one side of the stick. Almost instantaneously, you've got to place weights, new generation, on the other side of the plate, or the plate is going to topple. Guys, just Put your mind on that. That is mind-blowing as far as how much infrastructure we have had to build over the last 140 years to make this work. And it does work. And it indeed is called the largest machine mankind has ever built, namely the electric grid in the Eastern Interconnection of the United States, because of the infrastructure we had to build to keep that plate running. Now, of course, storage changes this, and we'll talk about that later. If you don't like the plate on the stick analogy, another analogy is that the transmission grid is like a swimming pool, and the level of the pool has to stay about the same at all times. It can vary just slightly. So as the tea kettles come on, somebody pulls a drain, the hose has to pour more water into the pool to keep those levels up about the same. All right. So you got the sense of the three different services buckets, generation, transmission, and distribution. Up here we've got the generation. This triangle here is the transmission, and down here, of course, we've got our tea kettles. That's the distribution system. Historically, again, it was all one-way flows from the generator down to the tea kettles. And so who actually oversees this industry? Historically, the state, and the state are blue circles, regulated what generation was built in their state, what transmission was built, as well as the distribution system. But the feds ended up taking over the transmission system because under the Interstate Commerce Clause of the Constitution, they said, hey, look, these flows are going amongst our states, and therefore we're going to take jurisdiction over that. They also took jurisdiction over the wholesale sale of electricity because, again, those flows were going between the states. All right. So this is Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, we've got three different kinds of electric service providers. One are public utilities, the second are municipal utilities, and the third are electric co-ops. And each of these different colors, and sorry it's a little blurry, but each of these different colors shows the different service territories of those utilities. The Public Service Commission of Wisconsin regulates the public utilities and the municipal utilities. They don't regulate the operations of the electric co-ops. The Public Service Commission also sets the electric rates for those two entities. They do regulate the construction of large generators and large transmission for all three of those entities. And when you're talking about building large infrastructure, keep in mind that this legacy infrastructure, this huge infrastructure, is really expensive, and the costs get put into rates. And so the commission needs to make sure that infrastructure is actually needed. So the first thing they do when they evaluate those applications are they determine whether or not the infrastructure is needed. If it is needed, then they turn their attention to where and how it's being sited or built. So that's what the PSCW does just generally. There's other things they do, but we won't get into those details. The utility's role is to provide safe, reliable, adequate electricity to the customers in its service territory at a reasonable cost. They need to determine, much like we talked about before, whether or not their infrastructure is sufficient to provide electricity to their customers. And if they don't have sufficient infrastructure, they have an obligation to go to the commission and ask for to build new infrastructure. The customer's role, if you're a customer and you've got generation behind the meter or some other kind of device, which we'll talk about a little bit later, your obligation is to make sure you don't mess up the shared system. You can mess up your own equipment, but don't mess up the shared distribution system. So our utilities in Wisconsin until the mid-1990s were what was called vertically integrated. So they did all three functions. They did the distribution function, they did the transmission function, and they did the generation function. In the 1990s, there were two events which were quite serious, and we almost had cascading outages in Wisconsin. And the governor said to the utilities, get your act together and figure this out. And what had happened was the utilities hadn't been building enough transmission in the state. And so the legislature ultimately decided to give the utilities the incentive to sell their transmission to a new entity, and that entity would then be responsible for building transmission. And indeed, that's exactly what happened. The utilities created the American Transmission Company. They sold their transmission assets. Most of the utilities sold their transmission assets to ATC. So ATC is only responsible for transmission. Their service territory is in the green area. XL Energy decided not to sell to ATC, and they remain vertically integrated. All righty. So as a result of the ATC, just as an aside, a lot more transmission did get built. And this is a little outdated. This is from 2015. It shows you the transmission lines and a few of the distribution lines in Wisconsin. And I just want to say a little bit about transmission technology. So there are two kinds of basic types of transmission technology. One is alternating current, or AC, and the other is direct current, or DC. Hey, did anybody see that bad movie, Culture? Current Wars. Yeah, one person, two people. Don't bother. I was all excited because it was the big fight between Tesla and Edison as to who was going to win. Of course, Tesla won. Tesla was the proponent of alternating current, and Edison the proponent of direct current. And here's the difference. So we generally have an alternating current transmission grid in the United States. There are a few DC lines, but for the majority, everything you see here is alternating current. In an alternating current, what happens is electricity flows through the path of least resistance. So imagine a spider web. You drop something in the spider web, and it just rolls through the spider web, wherever it has least resistance. And as a consequence, you know, some people, whenever you build new transmission lines, want only electricity from renewables, for instance, to go through the grid. That is not possible with AC because the electrons, you know, the electricity currents are just moving through the spider web as they see fit. Now, for direct current, it's different. And I like to think of direct current as a wormhole. Essentially, you drop electricity down on one side of the wormhole, and it pops up on the other side of the wormhole. And it is very efficient, and it's really controllable. And indeed, where the electricity pops up on the other side, it mimics having a generator there. So let's just say you've got a DC line starting in, I don't know, Iowa or North Dakota, where there's a lot of wind, and popping up in Milwaukee. It would be like essentially siting a wind generator in Milwaukee. The downside of DC lines is they are very expensive. So normally you only have really long DC lines, and you don't see a lot of those in the United States. All right. Let's just see. So the federal government in the 1990s started to make some pretty significant changes in federal law, which ended up changing the industry pretty significantly. They started opening up the industry in the 1970s, but really as far as the transmission grid, the transformation happened in the 1990s. They opened up transmission to competition. So as I indicated before, usually utilities would build their transmission from maybe their neighbors. They wouldn't build long transmission lines because they didn't need to. And indeed, utilities had complete control over the transmission lines. So you know what? If they had a lot of capacity on their transmission lines, they didn't have to sell it to anybody. Well, that changed. In 1992, Congress said, if you have extra capacity on your transmission lines, you need to be able to sell it. You need to open it up for anybody who wants to buy it. And I believe it was in 1996, FERC finally came out with rules that said, look, we're literally going to have a bulletin board. And if you have extra capacity, you got to put your transmission capacity up on that bulletin board, and anybody can buy it. Now, imagine what that meant. That meant at that point in time that somebody in Ohio could buy electricity from Wisconsin if they could purchase enough of the transmission capacity pulling it off of that bulletin board. So it seriously changed the model in which we were using transmission at that time. Another bold change that happened in the 1990s was in 1990, FERC said, you know what, transmission owners, you can start your own regional transmission organizations or operators, or independent system operators. And what that meant was you could work with each other to create an entity which would essentially act as a traffic cop over your transmission. And indeed, Wisconsin joined the, at that time it was the Midwest ISO, but now it's the Mid-Continent ISO. So we're in MISO, which is the blue area, and these are all the other areas that chose to join either RTOs or ISOs. Now, here are some of the functions of an RTO or ISO. Again, this was a big change. MISO created an energy market. Now, what happens in an energy market is if you're a generator, you bid in for the next day how much electricity you're going to be able to provide into the market. And if you are a load-serving entity, if you're a utility and you've got customers, you put in offers as far as how much you will be willing to purchase. And what the market manager does is they match up those bids and offers. And so they start with the lowest cost generation and match it up with an offer, and then they just move up. So as you can imagine, think about this, only those most efficient generators get picked in the energy market. Only those most efficient generators get picked in the energy market, unless it's a really hot day and then everybody gets purchased. But at that point in time, you've got a lot of generators who are no longer operating. And when you aren't operating, what aren't you getting? You're not getting money. And so you're seeing more and more retirements because the least efficient generators aren't producing revenues and it's not worth it for the utilities to keep them running. All right. So let me just make sure. We've got the energy markets, the direction of traffic on the electric grid. That's another thing that the RTOs do. Essentially, they make sure that plate doesn't topple over. Another thing that MISO does is they do transmission planning. And so they need to make sure, right, they're responsible, along with the transmission owners, of the transmission grid in this light blue area. And so they need to make sure that they have sufficient transmission to move the electricity around. And that is a huge challenge, especially right now, because the generation portfolios are changing so rapidly, right? So we've got coal plants retiring. We've got natural gas plants coming online. We got, thank God, a lot of wind and solar coming online. And as new generators, you know, are located in different parts of the grid, MISO needs to make sure that the grid, that plate, stays stable. And there are two different ways in which MISO does planning. One is called, it's called top-down and bottom-up. So for the bottom-up planning from MISO, what they do is they say to each of the transmission owners, you tell us, essentially from a reliability perspective, what kind of transmission projects you need to keep your grid stable. And they take those and they usually just adopt them. And then the other is the top-down kind of long-term planning that the MISO does. And it's pretty sophisticated. They use scenario planning. And they determine, essentially, who knows what scenario planning is? Okay, not that many. So what they do is they develop hypothetical worlds 10 or 20 years out. And a hypothetical world, for example, might be we're going to assume X penetration of electric vehicles. We're going to assume X penetration of renewables. And then they develop what the generation portfolio would look like for those hypothetical worlds. And then they figure out, well, do we have the transmission to accommodate those scenarios? And if not, then they propose transmission lines for those scenarios. Now, that sounds all well and good. It hasn't been working as well as we would like, because moving from coming up with those plans to actually developing some of those transmission lines hasn't been as fast as we had hoped, and I'll talk about that in a minute. All right. So... Sure. MISO, wait, let me go back. MISO is the Mid-Continent ISO, and so it is the blue area right here, and it is our the regional transmission organization that we have joined, we being Wisconsin. That's the ISOs. Yeah, and those ISOs are usually single states, so we've got actually, now I'm seeing it's New England ISO as well. But if somebody asked me the difference between an ISO and RTO, I don't know. This, by the way, is the MISO control room. This is where they do the direction of traffic. This is a cool place to be. Because literally, see up here? You can see that is the transmission grid, and they are watching to see if lines are overloading, if generators are going down. They're making sure that plate stays on that stick. Where is it? They've got that operating room in Carmel, Indiana. They've got another operating room in St. Paul, Minnesota. They have another operating room in Arkansas, I believe. So they've got them in a variety of places. I think they have one secret location, which is not surprising. Okay. So you're a renewable generation developer, and you want to interconnect to the grid. One of the things that MISO is responsible for is to ensure, again, that that plate doesn't topple, that wherever you want to put your generator and you're interconnecting to the grid, that the grid can accept that electricity. All right. And it sort of makes sense. You're inputting a lot of electricity into a certain area. The lines in that area have to be large enough to accommodate those new flows, or the lines literally will melt. And so what MISO does is they go in and they do an evaluation of how much infrastructure needs to be built to accommodate that new infusion of electricity. And this is the process. We are not going to go through this, thank God. But it just shows you that there are three different phases. And at each phase, they tell you a little bit about the infrastructure you need, here a little bit more. And then there it gets really definitive as far as how much infrastructure any generation developer is going to need to build to accept that new electricity. Now, of course, if the grid is already pretty robust, the amount of infrastructure needed there is not all that big. But we are finding, at least in MISO North, that the grid right now is not sufficient enough to accept a lot of new generators. And as a consequence, they just went through their DPP 2017 process. And what happened in that process, normally the amount of folks in the generation queue, 75% of them drop out for one reason or another. I mean, it's just when they find out how much they have to pay or, you know, they find a better site, whatever the case may be, 75% drop out. 25% usually stay in. But what we have just witnessed is the amount of new infrastructure that's needed for these generators in MISO North. They are so expensive that it might be that all of them are going to drop out. So we'll be down to 0%. And that's a bad thing. And that's because MISO said, look, if you guys want to interconnect at your locations, you essentially have to build some really big lines in order for the system to accept your lines. So MISO knows they've got an issue that's not a good place to be, and they are working on that. This is an example of the MISO queue right now. This PJM and SPP are two other RTOs, if you're wondering what those are. This is MISO. To give you an example, in the MISO queue, there's 86 gigawatts. MISO's peak load on a hot day is 122 gigawatts. So that's there's a lot of generators in the queue right now. Again, 75% of that usually drops out. But what's interesting here, too, is 87% of the generators in the queue are either renewables or storage or hybrid of the two. Alrighty. So the good news is, I'm going to check my time. Okay, good. Both wind and solar are intermittent resources if they don't have storage combined with them. And as a consequence, they have created a bit of a challenge for our legacy grid. Now, keep in mind, our legacy grid was built for firm generation, right? It was built not for intermittent generation, but for firm generation. And as a consequence, as it's starting to transform over to accommodate more and more intermittent generation, there are some challenges with regards to keeping that plate on a stick. And the good news is there's lots of people are working on this to figure out how to resolve the issue. Storage is the holy grail in all of that, because storage will firm up solar and wind, so it essentially mimics a firm resource. But there are other things that MISO is doing to assist in keeping that plate on the stick, even in the face of this kind of wind volatility. This just shows the wind volatility in one day in MISO. The numbers over here are megawatts, and you can see it really jumps up and down all over the place. Just some quick examples as to what can be done right now besides technology controls, geographic diversity. So if you have wind located in a lot of different areas, for instance in MISO, that helps them to smooth it out. MISO has become masters at weather predictors, right? When they first started out, they were just learning, and now they're fantastic. So they can actually predict much better as to when the wind is going to go up and down, and it allows them to help ramp other resources up to help stabilize the grid. Of course, as I indicated, storage is the holy grail in all of this, which we'll talk about in a minute. And then another thing, I'm just going to jump back here. One moment. We can use this map. So you can see that MISO has a service territory in the north and the south. And the solar resources are better in the south. We still have reasonably good solar resources here, but they're really good down south. And, of course, in the north, we've got really good wind resources. The intermittency of solar and wind are opposite each other, right? And so one of the things MISO could do is essentially allow transfers between MISO North and MISO South between wind and solar. Now, that's going to require a heck of a lot more transmission between the two areas of MISO. I am not going to... Whoops, wait. I forgot. I went backwards. So another thing that is happening right now in the transmission area is we're trying to improve the efficiency of the grid. So improve the efficiency and also improve the controls. As I talked about before, historically, there weren't really any controls on the electricity flowing through the grid. It went through the path of least resistance. There are new technologies out there right now that, and some of them aren't all that new, but they are now getting deployed, that allow utilities to actually control where the electricity flows through lines, and that does allow for more efficient deployment of electricity. And another thing that happens is the dynamic line ratings. Literally, the more electricity that goes through a transmission line, the line sags. And when the weather's hot, the line sags. As you can imagine, and PG&E knows quite well, you don't want lines to sag so much. Well, historically, they just used generic standards for how much electricity could go through a specific line. And it was, as you can imagine, pretty conservative because they wouldn't want lines to sag that much. Dynamic line ratings are actually, they physically measure the sags and lines, combine that with local temperatures so that they know exactly what's going on with a specific line. So that allows them to more accurately actually put more electricity through those lines when it's safe. So that's what dynamic line ratings are. All right. Very quickly, if I do this right, we'll have about 10 minutes for Q&A. So this industry is outstanding right now. It's so dynamic and changing probably faster than it's ever changed, except for back when Thomas Edison created the Pearl Street Station. I am not going to go through all the game changers. I'm only going to go through two. I do want to note that I'm not going to talk about the phenomenal drop in prices of solar and wind over the last 10 years. It has been breathtaking, and it has absolutely changed the industry, turned it upside down. I'm not going to talk about those two. I am going to talk about demand response and efficiency. Remember, we talked about utilities would determine how much infrastructure to build. based on their guess as to how much customers needed, right? So whatever the customers needed, we're going to build the infrastructure necessary for it. That is now changing, which is a good thing. Now utilities are saying, how much can we incent customers to change their behaviors so that during peak times, they aren't using their washing machines, their clothes dryers, their air conditioners? What can we do to change customer behavior? And demand response is that's when you're shifting the load from one time of day to different days. And what that allows you to do, of course, is remember those expensive peaker plants, right? If you can cut off the peaks by demand response or efficiency, right, you don't need as many peaker plants. So it's going to save everybody a lot of money. So demand response is a way in which to essentially conserve electricity. All right, the Holy Grail. There's a lot of different kind of storage out there, and I just am putting up the lithium ion battery prices, which have dropped 85% between 2010 and 2018. 85%. I'm just going to say that again. 85%. And there is so much R&D going into storage because everybody does know this is the Holy Grail. That we expect continuous drops. Now, storage is already being deployed in Wisconsin in certain areas, even though it's a little expensive. Once storage prices really drop and it becomes cost competitive, think about this, guys. That plate on the stick, obsolete. The legacy infrastructure that we built, obsolete. So this is the Holy Grail. Our industry will look completely different once storage actually, the prices drop even further and become cost competitive. All right. So where are we now? Going back to the jurisdictional, we still have our central station generation, as everybody knows. We've got our transmission grid, but we now have storage in the grid, right? Up here, we've got some renewable energy tied with storage, so this is a firm resource. Down here, the Brits, they're still drinking tea. And we now, however, have generation on houses, right? We've got solar PV here. We've got some demand response. And I did not talk about this game changer, but EVs are another of the game changers. And EVs, by the way, can provide grid support, so it need not be a one-way one-way direction of just pulling electricity off the grid. They can provide support to the grid. So we still have the states. They still have control over the generation. They still have control over the distribution system, sort of. There we go. That's a generation facility, so they've got control over that. Feds still have control over that. But what do we got? We have two-way flows now. And with that, the federal government is now starting to move more and more into what was historically within just the state domain. And this is obviously pretty controversial. And the reason they do this, imagine, is because, right, you've got flows that are coming from what are historically customers into the wholesale system. And once you do that, that essentially triggers federal jurisdiction over the areas. So not only have we vast and exciting changes in technology, but we also have some pretty vast and significant changes in the regulatory regime as well. So with that, I'm open for questions. Please.
Right away, the battery issue dropped 85% so far.
That was, 2018, so that's...
Where do you think it's going? How much more does it need to drop so that...
Darn, I wish I... Yeah, so how fast? I mean, the faster it goes, the faster the industry is going to change. I would urge you, and honestly, I don't have this memorized. The Department of Energy puts a lot of money into R&D. They just announced a challenge in the storage area, and they've announced how far they want the pricing to go with storage. So I'd urge you to look for the DOE storage challenge, which literally I think was just announced about 10 days ago. And that'll give you some benchmarks. Yes?
Is storage the reason some people are saying we don't need more transmission lines?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that is part of it, and also distributed energy. So whenever you say we don't need more transmission lines, if we had trillions or quadrillions of dollars to spend right now, we could obviate the need for a big transmission build-out. We aren't there. And so one of our challenges are, of course, I believe in climate change. What a shock. We've got to change this, the generation portfolio very quickly in order to keep the temperatures down. We don't have time to wait. So part of the reason to do the transmission build-out right now is money and time. Please.
How long do you think it'll take before we have vehicle to grid, you know, in other words, what you were talking about with the electric vehicles actually, you know, supplying some of the power to make up for peaking demand?
I am really bad at predicting. I know there's a vehicle EV session this afternoon.
Yeah.
I would go to that.
Okay.
Yeah. Please. Yeah. MISO, it's very interesting because they've done the scenario planning in certain ways for the last 5 or 10 years. They are changing them up significantly this year. And I don't know the percentage of storage used in the scenarios for this year that they're proposing. They're still developing them. But I can tell you the good news is the scenarios that they're using right now are really much more aggressive than any ones that they have used in the past. So I can't give you specific numbers, but I'm sure there's storage in there. Yep. Please. Yes, some of them are. I'm not sure they all are, but yes. Yeah, behind. So smart grid is, that's a rather ambiguous term. I'm assuming you're talking about on the distribution system.
I don't know.
Okay. Fair enough. Okay, I'm going to answer in two ways then. So it's a very ambiguous term. So confusion is completely fine in that area. So on the distribution system, a smart grid includes things like demand response controls that we had there. And I want to give you an example of some of the smart grid things that can happen. Number one, utilities, for instance, could, and they do, some of them have direct control over people's air conditioners. So on peak days, they literally can shut down or turn down your air conditioner if you sign up for that program. So those kind of interactions between the utility and the customer are part of the smart grid, and that is going to happen more and more and more. Utilities really want to work with customers to try to help drive down those peak loads. Now, on the transmission grid, you can talk about the smart grid on the transmission grid, and it's getting pretty complicated. So let me just say that's possible, but what it does have to do with is more control over the grid. So those flow controls that I talked about, those dynamic line ratings, that would be part of the transmission grid, smart grid. But when you hear the word smart grid, they're usually talking about the distribution system. Please. Vice versa. So it's going, the control is going more from state to federal. Yes?
In the vein of not knowing what I'm talking about, so thank you for that. I feel embarrassed. I think this was going to expose some ignorance.
This is a primer.
There was a point in your conversation where you stopped and you said, think about it. This changes everything. This is a game changer. And I think it had to do with storage. Mm-hmm. why?
Yeah.
Why is it?
No, absolutely, because it actually gives me the shivers as far as how big of a change it is. We built a legacy system based on that very first slide from, you know, central station generation to the customer. I don't know if you've ever seen a central station power plant. Those things are massive. They're absolutely massive. And the transmission grid, you know, is massive. Largest machine ever built by mankind. The reason we had to build all that infrastructure is because of the need to do those instantaneous responses between generation and and demand, between the, you know, when the Brits turn on those kettles, you need to ramp up those generators, and you need all that infrastructure in between. If you had storage right besides the Brits' home, you don't need everything else.
So the storage turns it into a firm. You talk about firm versus.
Yeah, it does
it. Grid built for firm loads.
Correct.
And renewables are
intermittent.
Intermittent, so the storage turns it back to firm.
It also turns. It's no longer a just-in-time commodity.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest change. Electricity still is a just-in-time commodity. Storage, it no longer becomes that.
Yeah.
Okay? Please.
Might be able to have a little
please.
So basically, when you turn a switch on, right, the lights have to go on. So an electricity utility has to, they can't run out of power, right? So that's called peak demand, right? So what happens in Madison is at 5 o'clock, everyone comes home, right? But if we're making renewable power, most of that is going to be made from 10 to 2. So if you could think of taking that excess stuff from 10 to 2 and you just shift it 4 hours from 2 to 6, then that helps smooth it out a little. That kind of makes sense. So instead of like this to this, it kind of does this thing. And so when electricity utilities have to pay for power, the price that they pay for power is at this peak rate. So if they can shave that down 5 to 10%, if you will, right, then that saves them power. So,
Thank you. Yes, please. Okay, I did not say grossly inefficient because people would beat me up if I used that term. But the system is not strong enough to accept new generation in certain areas of the MISO footprint. And the answer to your question is both. I mean, if the lines that we had were larger, that would help. And I don't know where these generation developers were planning on putting their lines, I mean their generation stations, but they may have needed transmission in new locations as well. Yes?
When you're talking about larger lines, you mean thicker cable or
more capacity? Both.
Both.
Yep.
Okay.
Please. So as far as the transmission grid, it's not changing very much at all. Really where it's changing is the Fed's jurisdiction over things that would have normally been considered on the distribution side. So transmission grid, sometime in the 1900s, they had really complete control over the grid, so that's not changing. It's more how much they're reaching down towards those electric kettles.
So it's still state policy that kind of has
remained
in control of
the more
electrical grid?
The more important electrical grid, girl. The state does have control over the distribution system. I didn't mean to embarrass you.
So, yeah, I think you might have mentioned this a little bit earlier, but you don't see an end to the ISO.
God, no. No, and let me just say, The RTOs and ISOs, can they be improved? Absolutely. But we are saving billions of dollars in Wisconsin because of it. And it goes back to, imagine, again, the electric generators that are lowest costs are the ones that are getting called on. So we're saving lots of money because of that. Again, we can improve them, but we're saving money. Please.
You mentioned that the direct current is so much more expensive. What is it? Is it the hardware or the...
Yes. It's literally the hardware. It's the hardware, and it's the conversion stations between the DC and the AC. So you've got to build, since our system is AC, you've got to convert the power. And those conversion stations are really expensive. Please.
My question might be strange. So I'm a school, and we pay for peak, obviously, and we pay way more for our demand than we actually use.
Yep.
And we're looking at battery storage. Do you see the cost structure changing with batteries, though? You know, that... Because if batteries are a game changer, all of a sudden utilities are going to need their money. And if I put batteries in to make my peak at 10 to 1.
That's a good question.
And then
yeah.
All of a sudden payback changes.
Understood.
Yeah.
So it is very important right now for us to protect the financial integrity of our utilities. Because... Well, no, and here's why, is because, you know, ultimately, if you think about this transformation that we are going to see, to be honest with you, the folks that are more well off are going to be able to do the transformation much faster than those that aren't. So we're going to have a chunk of the community that is going to be left behind. That's correct.
Yeah.
And the utilities are legally obligated to provide electricity to the folks that can't afford the transformation. And so,
you will.
Yes, the answer is yes.
Okay. It's really risky if you're not first.
Is it risky? I think you should expect some changes. Utilities are going to have to stay financially solid. And so, whether or not that's the place where they move to try to retain their financial wherewithal, I don't know. But the bottom line is, it is not a bad thing, guys, because we've got to lift all boats. We can't lift just the rich folks up. And so we need to make sure that... we need to make sure that everybody's ultimately able to get electricity until we can transform the entire industry. And I know that was probably confusing to some people, and if you've got questions about that, come see me afterwards.
But
well, I don't know if it's going to be a change in your specific rate structure. They are going to have to make it up somewhere.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, please.
In the MESO West study group, there are literally billions of dollars of upgrades needed for the study groups.
Yep.
And last I had a thumb on the pulse, there was some discussion about whether it would be possible to have more structured intervention in the state or federal to help facilitate some of those upgrades, precisely because of the reason that you mentioned that, you know, nearly 100% of people would drop out from the study group. And that's just, I wanted to ask you if you've heard or know of any other further developments about how to tackle that multi-billion-dollar upgrade necessity specifically for MISO West.
So I was just on the phone with MISO 2 days ago talking about this very issue. They know they've got a challenge ahead of them and are trying to figure it out. I don't really necessarily see, it won't be state intervention, it would be federal intervention, and that probably won't happen without a complaint to FERC. There are a lot of things moving in MISO right now. As I indicated, their scenarios are changing really quite dramatically this time, and I would expect there's going to be some more changes. So I'm hopeful, but the fix is not going to be overnight. This is going to take a few years, unfortunately. I wish it was overnight, but it's probably not going to be.
Yeah, I was just going to say, in response to the gentleman's question about storage and changes in rate structure, I think it's also important to recognize that there's significant overcapacity on the generation side. So fossil fuel plants operate at 40-60% capacity factors. You've mentioned the distribution system is designed for that peak day. So to the extent that utilities can leverage the existing infrastructure more efficiently with the same amount of energy being produced, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to have cost increases going up. There's significant opportunities to use the system more efficiently. And I think that's one of the challenges that will also be facing utilities as they wrestle with what you're talking about.
And all of the large utilities in Wisconsin have agreed to make some pretty significant changes in their generation portfolios towards lower carbon or zero carbon. So there are going to be changes no matter what, even though there is overcapacity at this point in time. Please.
Coming from the contractor's perspective, comparing Minnesota to Wisconsin, and Minnesota has solar 2 years ahead of Wisconsin, maybe, and there were large scale programs, and it got pushed down to smaller scale community solar gardens due to the, the grid we're talking about, essentially, along with some regulation. I'm assuming they're probably figuring that 3 to 4 years out before they finally regulate larger gardens again. From the perspective over there, it's that it'll take a minimum of that much time for a cell to prepare to put larger gardens in on the grid again. Your study of this and talking with MISO and seeing that Wisconsin has opened a utility scale size portfolio or to that now, what's your knowledge of the grid and the set in Wisconsin and the ability to start handling large solar installations over here or more wind?
So I don't have that kind of granular knowledge, and I probably wouldn't, even if I did, say it out loud in front of that camera. But I would assume that there are places in Wisconsin, in fact, I'm pretty confident, where you could develop a utility-scale renewables right now with existing or just minor upgrades to the grid. But you've got to be, I would go talk to Xcel and I would go talk to ATC and have them identify areas where they would think you could inject new electricity without significant upgrades. And then you could start going through that really complicated process at MISO. So with this, guys, last question, because I know you've got to get to the main session. Please. In Illinois, they allow retail choice, so you can essentially choose your electricity provider. Ultimately, those electricity providers are usually buying from the utility anyway. Wisconsin has decided not to deregulate its industry further than it already has and allow retail choice. So that is a difference in state law. And with that, thank you very much. Enjoy your day and appreciate your participation.